We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
And this is Focus, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Sandy Mason is here, and we'll take your lawn and garden questions this morning. And just before we get going here, I just do want to mention that we are also this week on the air asking for your financial support for these programs that you value. We are raising the money that will help pay for the programs next year. And as I'm sure that you have heard, we're really, like everybody, we're really facing some very tight budget times mainly because of the very difficult budget situation here in the state of Illinois. It has affected the university. That affects us. It has actually affected us directly. And over the past couple of years, we have lost very significant state support. So what we're doing is turning to you, the people who listen, and say, you know, you always have been, at least for a long time now, you have been the major source of support for the station. And that in the future is going to continue to be true. What we want to do is keep doing the work that you value. You're giving us the tools to do that with your support. So if you are not a supporter of WILL, a financial supporter, why don't you call us at 217-244-9455 and make a pledge. You can also go online. Go to willpledge.org. Now, if you have questions about things that grow in the home landscape, you are certainly welcome to call. It's a different number. It's the one we always use, but no one is going to waylay you and ask you for money. That is not required. If you'd like to talk to Sandy, you can call us, and we'll put you right in touch with her. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And we also do have email. So if you'd like to do it that way, you can do that. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. And Sandy will do her best to help you out with your questions. And maybe you have a problem you need to solve, or maybe you would like maybe say a recommendation of a particular plant. You have some place in your yard. You can say, okay, here's the conditions. Here's kind of what I'm looking for. Maybe you might suggest a couple of things. She can do that. So any and all of those kind of questions are certainly welcome. Thank you very much.
Good morning.
For being here. It's certainly spring.
I think it's summer.
Well,
I think
whatever.
We moved into May and forgot March.
We had this explosive spring, and then that seemed to go really. And yesterday I was outside. I was doing a little grilling. I was walking around, and I was thinking to myself. I came inside, reported to my wife, well, the Creeping Charlie and the garlic mustard are doing really well already. And one day I was looking in the backyard, and suddenly everywhere I looked, there was garlic mustard.
Yeah.
And, you know, at least I know what it is. You can try to pull it up. It hasn't gone to seed yet. But I'm looking around, and the darn stuff is everywhere.
Yeah. And if people aren't familiar with it, it's one of those plants. It actually is a biennial, so it's really easy to miss it the first year. So it forms a sort of rosette of leaves. It looks a lot like, you know, a lot of people say maybe it looks like violets, but it has a little bit more of a pinked edge to it, sort of a rounded, scalloped edge to it.
Yeah.
It does definitely have a garlic smell to it, so if you break off one of the leaves. And then the second year, it sends up this flower stalk, and that's when you really notice that it's that second year. And that's why it's really important to get rid of it now, you know, as it's starting to form that seed head, because you don't want it to go to seed. It is easy to pull up. I know it's not much fun, but there's not much of a root system to it. So it is important to go ahead and pull it up now before it goes ahead and sets seed.
Okay. So if you don't know what this stuff is, if you can, go on the web or go someplace and look for some pictures so you'll know it when you see it, because really, You want to get rid of it.
And it's one of those things that we've been fighting it in woodland areas, natural areas, for years now. And I've been surprised on how much it has moved into backyard gardens over the last few years. And I even found some. I couldn't believe it. I live out in the land of corn and soybeans, so I'm not really very near any kind of a woodland area so much, at least a couple miles from a woodland area. And I found some in my backyard. Really? I was really surprised. It was just one plant, but I was so surprised that it was there, because I couldn't figure out how it came in. So it is it is one of those things that definitely you want to start in the beginning and take care of it now.
And this is a non-native species.
Right.
It's very invasive.
Right.
I guess it was one of those things that a long time ago when people came to this country on this side of the water, they brought it as a salad
item.
Sure, you know, people,
sure.
It was something, and it just got away from them.
Yeah, it hasn't been a very good neighbor.
No.
And actually, one of the problems with it, too, is that it'll actually keep, you know, people are, I think, familiar with walnuts and how they can keep other plants from growing around them. Garlic mustard can do the very similar thing. And so what we found in woodland areas in particular is the fact that it can actually choke out a lot of the native wildflowers, and that's not good. So you can also imagine what it could do in your own yard. We don't quite know exactly how it works in ornamental-type plantings like that, but it certainly could have the same kind of effect. It actually could sort of take over your whole area and you wouldn't have anything else but garlic mustard.
Okay. No.
So enough of that.
Go
so
after
garlic
it.
Mustard. And actually, I have had a couple of people said they made pesto out of it and it wasn't too bad. So
really?
If you can't beat it, eat it, I figure.
Okay.
What do you
I
think?
Guess that's, I don't, well, I, as a,
that's
as a
what it was.
Slogan, okay. But I'm not so sure.
You're
I'm,
not sold.
I don't think I'm going to move from basil. I think I'm going to stick with that for my pesto.
Well.
We have a caller ready to go. Bloomington, Illinois. Well, let's talk with them. Line 4.
Hi. I have a couple of questions, and so if you don't have time to answer them both, I understand. The most important one is there any recommendations that she can give for getting rid of wild violets? And the second is we have an area of extremely dry shade, like under the eaves of the house, and we also have a maple tree growing nearby. Is there anything that we can get to grow there other than the wild violets? We're having trouble getting you know, ground cover and grass to grow in that area.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I think a couple of things. Well, wild violets, you know, they are pretty. I know. I'm not convincing people probably too much, but
no,
you know.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I know. Okay, I try. I got it. Got at least
next
try
thing you'll be,
that.
You'll be telling us that.
Damn
it.
Yeah.
So I think the one thing with wild violets is there aren't a whole lot of things that are going to kill off the big plants that have been there for a while. They just really don't seem to do much with those. So I think if there's any way you can, but they do hoe out or actually pull out fairly easily. So I'm afraid if you really want to get, you really have to get rid of that seed source, because as long as those mother plants are there, you're always going to have that seed source.
Okay.
And so you kind of just have to go with it and try to get those rid of those as much best as you can. Then herbicides do a pretty good job on the young seedlings as those come up. So if you were to use it in a lawn area, then certainly some of the broadleaf weed killers, those kind of things, do a pretty good job on the young stuff. They just don't do a very good job on the older stuff. So once you get rid of the mother plants, then you'll probably have a lot better success just by physically removing those mother plants. And of course, now they're flowering, so you want to get them before they set seed.
Okay.
So it's really important to go ahead and do that now. So as far as what you can put in there, there are some perennials that actually do fairly well in dry shade, with one caveat that pretty much all of them have to have some water when you first plant them. They just, until they get established, they're not quite as drought tolerant. So you kind of have to keep that in mind for that first year. And there are a few things. Actually, one of the things that I really like are, and they have a horrible name, and I wish we had a better name for these. And I'll just go by the genus is Lamium. But they're also known as dead nettle, which is a horrible name. What part of that name, dead and nettle? How can that possibly be a good thing? But they actually are very attractive ground covers. And once they get established, they're actually pretty good in dry shade. And the thing I like about them is they do have a flower, and you can get anything from, there's one called White Nancy, and there's another one I think it's called Purple Robe. So they have either white flowers or pink or purple flowers, depending on which ones you get. But they have this nice kind of silvery leaf to them. And depending on which variety you get, it's a little bit different. But I think the nice thing is it really awakens that really shady spot by having something with that silver leaf. It really brightens it up a lot. So I think that's one of the reasons I like it. And it's pretty tough stuff, and it will spread out as a ground cover, and you get the flowers and the whole thing. So those are really nice. So you might look for the lamiums. And also just even things like sweet woodruff is another ground cover that once it gets established is pretty good in those shadier spots. There's another one called Epimedium. And I'm trying to think of what the common name is. It might be Bishop's Hat, I think maybe might be the common name for that. But Epimedium is another one of those. It's a little taller ground cover, but actually, again, once it's established, it's really pretty good in shadier spots. They have really interesting leaves, and they have really kind of small flowers, but interesting flowers. So there's a couple there that I think you'll find. The perennial forget-me-not is actually not a bad one. And again, you can get kind of silvery leaves in those. As you can see, I kind of like those brighter leaves in those shadier spots. So the first year, you're going to have to water them.
Okay.
And then after that, they're pretty good and self-sufficient once you get through that.
Okay. And so are those, are they invasive? Will they keep spreading? Should we put up, like, a barrier so they don't, like, take over the whole yard or...
I haven't seen any of it. Now, probably out of all of those, I would say probably the Lamium is the one that will spread,
okay.
But which is what you kind of want. I haven't seen it move into a lawn area. I suppose it has that ability, but it doesn't spread. I haven't found it to spread to the point where you're, like, cussing at it the whole time. It does spread, but what I do is then I just, where it feels like it's getting a little bit out of its bounds, then I just dig up that little piece and I move it somewhere else so they have another ground. So it's kind of like self-perpetuating that way.
Okay.
So I don't think you're going to have to do any barriers or anything along those lines with these.
Oh, that's great. Thank
okay,
you so much.
Good luck.
All right, thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Did you know, by the way, that some Epimedium are thought to be aphrodisiacs?
And yet I didn't know that.
I'm not kidding you. And in fact, some of the common names include rowdy lamb herb and horny goatweed. I am not making this up, ladies. No, it's Wikipedia. And of course, as
horny
we know,
goatweed.
Everything on Wikipedia has
gonna
to be
I am
going to
start
true.
Using that name.
I think you
I'm
should.
I'm going to start using that name.
I think you should.
It's much more fun than that.
So
media.
There you go. Bishop's horny hat. Yes, that actually
that is one of the,
that is one of them.
Bishop's hat,
Bishop's hat
and horny goatweed.
Horny
all the
goatweed.
Same plant.
Yes.
Is horticulture wonderful or what?
Well, there you go. And I try to get really exciting stuff
that.
In here. People, you know, one of the mottos for our show is the show that dares to be dull. So I'm trying to get some more exciting stuff in there. And nature is just
horny
so, you know,
goatweed.
Natural.
Horny goatweed.
All right. To Urbana next. Line number one. Hello.
Hello. Along the same line, my neighbor was asking me what would be a good ground cover for a ditch. Apparently, it's an area that gets enough traffic that it's difficult to establish anything. And the only thing I could think of was vinca. Would that be an acceptable, tough ground cover?
Yeah. So this is a full sun, I take it?
No, this is shade.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I should have said that.
Yeah, no, that's fine. So what they're trying to do is they just don't want to have to mow it, I take it?
Right.
Okay.
And I think the kids run through there.
Okay. Does it need to be something that's particularly short?
I don't think so.
Okay. And does this, I assume it's a ditch, it floods periodically?
That's my understanding.
Okay.
I've never seen it.
Yeah. So I guess I'd have a couple ideas if he doesn't really care if it gets taller than what we typically might think of with ground covers or maybe some of the shorter ground covers like the vinca. Well, I think vinca would probably work fine. Probably even things like, and you might even think about some of the lobelias. There's great blue lobelia, which is a native plant.
Oh, yeah,
and it kind of spread. It doesn't spread, you know, massive amounts, but it'll, you know, the clump will certainly get bigger if they want to think about that. Any of the day flowers or the tradescantia, you know, they actually spread quite prolifically, I think, and they'll certainly take wet periods, which I think those are good. But, of course, those are a little bit taller. You know, we're talking about a foot or so. But they do have a flower, and you can either get there's certainly ones that with different colors, flowers from white to purple to you name it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd have a little bit of flower color there. That one probably is one that's going to spread out much more than lobelias might. So you might think about that. Also, I guess maybe even daylilies, you know, they'll take some. You know, obviously they're not going to flower as well in shadier conditions, but if he's just looking for something to sort of cover the area, they'll certainly live in shade. They just don't flower as well.
Mm-hmm. They're tough.
Yeah, they're tough. And usually you can, there's always somebody giving them away. So they're usually cheap if you're not too terribly picky about what the actual one is. And certainly even things like Siberian iris, I would think, in those kind of spots. Again, something taller, but certainly would tolerate those periods of wetness that probably in a ditch he's going to get. So I would think maybe kind of along those lines and consider maybe some of the taller things.
The red lobelia, what is it, cardinal weed?
Yeah.
Or what is it called?
Yeah, cardinalis or cardinal flower, which is, again, is a very nice one. And it actually likes moist soil. So, if he doesn't mind having something that's a little bit taller, you know, those kind of things actually work out really well. Swamp milkweed is another one that actually, again, it doesn't have the best name in the world, but it is against taller plant, but will tolerate, certainly does well in those kind of wetter areas or areas that might stay wet for periods of time. So even thinking about some of those native plants that like those wetter spots, you might find that that's nice. And it's certainly more interesting than just having plain old one kind of ground cover. So,
well, thank you.
Sure. Good luck.
Thank you. Our guest in this hour of Focus, Sandy Mason. She is a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. Monthly on a Tuesday, she is here. We talk about lawn and garden care. So this is your chance to call in and ask questions about issues in the home, landscape, trees, shrubs, flowers, lawn and care. If you want to talk about ornamental stuff, that's fine. You want to talk about things you're going to eat, that's fine. Any and all those kinds of things, we are here to try to help out with solving problems and suggesting plants. And I know Sandy will do her best to help you out. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Up next, another Urbana person here, line two. Hello.
Hi. Yes, I have a couple of questions. One is if you have any advice on how to get rid of or severely depress well-established Star of Bethlehem in a lawn.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other question is, what effect has a black walnut tree on growing sort of either ornamentals or vegetables within its range?
Well, the Star of Bethlehem, if people aren't familiar with that, it sends up all these, it almost looks like maybe even a wild onion or something, but it sends up, you know this, but for everybody else's benefit, this time of year you'll see all these green, really kind of succulent looking leaves. They're not terribly tall, maybe 4 inches, 4 or 5 inches they'll send up. And then later on in the season, they actually send up this white flower, which is actually, you know, kind of pretty, but they tend to be fairly invasive.
Yeah,
they kind of go all over the place. So they're really, unfortunately, the broadleaf weed killers don't really do much with these plants because they're in that sort of lily family that isn't really affected by things like dandelion killer or any of those. So we don't really have any really good, it's too closely related to grass, unfortunately, and so we have some problems trying to get rid of it with anything that's selective.
Yeah.
So unfortunately, I know this probably isn't what you want to hear, it does form a bulb, and that's part of the problem. It forms these tiny little bulbs, and of course, even if you kill off the top, then the bulb just it sends up a new plant. So it's really, they are difficult. So I will tell you, just mowing them off, obviously, as you see them, and certainly so they don't set seed. And then, and I know you're not going to want to hear this, but actually digging them out is probably your best bet in getting rid of those.
Hand-to-hand combat.
Hand-to-hand combat. And you know, sometimes, unfortunately, any of these things that form those bulbs like that, like nutsedge or, you know, any of those that form those bulbs are very difficult to get rid of without physically getting rid of the bulb.
Yeah, and even when you pull them out, there's lots of little tiny bulbs that fall off as you're pulling them.
Of course.
The clump out.
Yeah, you almost need to like sift the soil when you're done. I know what you mean. But I think just sticking with it, and this may be one of those things that where you just kind of have to keep working at it, and eventually you'll find you'll start to deplete them. But yeah, it may be a more than 1 year process, unfortunately. So.
Well, it's 20 years so far.
20 years? Oh, no. I give you credit for your tenacity. you gotta outwit them and outlast them and go for it. Okay, the black walnut, sorry. Black walnuts certainly have effect on other plants. Now, it varies, and unfortunately, even if you look at the information out there from the universities, they all kind of have different opinions about which plants are affected. Certain plants we know are affected, things like tomatoes and peppers and those kind of plants are highly affected by, and they actually stunt the growth. And that would be the common thing that you'd see. It wouldn't be outright death of the plant around it, but it just stunts them. So I would check. Actually, Purdue has a fairly nice fact sheet. If you go online and get their fact sheet, it lists the plants that are felt to be, you know, not susceptible to the injury from juglone from walnut trees, and the ones that are felt to be, yes, susceptible to it. So you kind of have to look through those lists. I will tell you, violets seem to grow very well walnut trees.
So, I mean, one of the concerns, the tree itself is not that close, mm-hmm. but the squirrels eat the fruits sitting on the fence and then drop all the casings from the fruit on the ground around it.
Right.
Are they a source of these toxic?
Yeah, unfortunately, all of it, to some extent, is going to have some of this juglone in it. Now, over time, of course, it leaches out, and you know, it's not the issue. But it's certainly that's why we tell people not to put it in their compost pile and those kind of things, simply because of those issues, unless you actually... So it's one of those things that if you had a few, you know, nuts or whatever around, it's probably not going to make a big difference with a plant. But it probably is more of an effect just from the roots of the tree. And, of course, the tree, if it's big, it's going to spread those roots out long distances, and you may find that there's more of an effect even beyond the drip line of the tree. So it is one of those things, and it's not just black walnuts. If you have English walnuts or any of those kind of nuts, actually will affect other plants. So yeah, okay. It's kind of a tough thing. Even if you cut the tree down, you would still have issues with the leftovers. You'd have big issues if you cut that tree down. I'm sorry I can't give you any really good solutions for either one of those. But
thank you.
Good luck.
Anyway.
Right. Okay.
We have a big black walnut in our backyard, and I can tell you a lot of stuff will grow under it, but it's probably nothing that you want.
Creeping Charlie probably.
Creeping Charlie. There's certainly plenty of violets. My poor wife tried at one point to establish a little wildflower garden there, woodland wild plants, and actually we had some trillium and some mayapple. They grew under there fine.
Yeah, sure.
But then some guy came along and put a wood pile on it. Now, I don't know who would have done such a thing. But, you know, I don't know. But,
who
you
would
know,
that
some,
have been?
I don't know.
In the middle of the night,
In the middle of the night, some guy came and put a wood pile there, and I don't
know
who was responsible.
Just wasn't thinking about that.
We're here to take your questions on lawn and garden care, but we're also here to ask for your support for the station. Sandy is here every month, and we do the show with her. She's not here to sell anything. She's here to try to, you know, bring the expertise of the University of Illinois and her expertise dealing with plants to folks and to answer questions. And we have a lot of other people like Sandy with different area of expertise who are on the program from time to time, too. And, you know, the idea is we got somebody here who's going to try to help you call in, ask your question, and we hope that will be useful to you. Well, we got to support that somehow. We're not selling advertising. The main thing we got to do is say to people who listen, okay, folks, now it's your turn. Huge chunk of our budget comes from listeners. And actually, we kind of like that. We'd rather it be that way than have to depend on government, because government's not that dependable. So now is one of those times that we're saying to folks, look, if you appreciate Focus and other shows that you hear on the station, what we want you to do is call us and make a pledge. And Jack Brighton is here in the studio. He's now overseeing our web operations, but he's also the man we like to call producer emeritus of Focus.
Thank you. A title I am proud of and will wear proudly for life. Giving you the phone number to call right now, 244-9455. That's our pledge line, because we have to do this every once in a while. We have to ask for you to join the Friends of WILL, especially if you never have before, because we know a lot of people move in and out of the area. A lot of people discover this is their NPR station. And if you love NPR and if you value programs like Focus, all the work that David has been doing and Sandy Mason and all the other great guests who come on the air and answer your questions and engage in deep conversations about important topics, this is your time to support that. Step up to the bat and make a pledge. And you can also go online to willpledge.org and support us there. Again, the phone number to call, 244-9455, area code 217. Just want to pass on that we have, as of last night, we had heard from about 330 people making a pledge during this pledge period. That's about a third of the way to our goal of 1,000 pledges by the end of the week. That's really good progress, folks, but we need to keep going here because the finish line is still somewhere in the distance. We have to get about 1,000 people calling to keep the service going for you all. So, again, 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org, and we really appreciate your support.
Yeah, we really, you know, sometimes we do talk about dollar goals, and I think this time around we said, well, we really want to do is have a people goal. And that's what that thousand is. And we want to have as broad and as solid a base of support as we can. And what that means is getting as many people as we can, listeners, to also be supporters. And one of the things that has not changed over the years is that most of the people who listen are not supporters. And if you have been listening for however long and you're not a contributing member, well, we really hope that you would do that, because what you're doing is you're giving us the tools to continue to do what we do. And that's what we want to do. We have a certain kind of place here, and we do certain kind of things, and we think they're pretty good, and we want to keep doing them. But without the resources to do that, which means the money that people contribute, you know, it's going to be a whole lot more difficult for us. So why don't you give us a call at 244-9455, or you can go online to willpledge.org and make that contribution. Well, thanks very much, and we'll continue to talk here with Sandy Mason. We have one person here ready to go. We have others who I'm sure will have questions. 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. There's someone over in Belgium, line one. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Good morning.
I have an observation to make and then a question. The observation is, back when I first started my relationship here with Mr. Inge 20-some years ago, I guess it's been now, I bought a piece of property, and way back then I thought I'd like to turn it into a prairie. Well, this piece of property is situated so it's in, has a stream that flows through it, and it's a low valley sort of thing, small valley. And, you know, prairies don't grow good there, but trees do. And the trees grew very nicely. I grew a lot of walnuts. Speaking of walnuts, I also have a couple of butternuts, which I hardly ask people, make sure you don't cut down a butternut. Butternuts have been blighted very, very badly, and there weren't very many in the first place. So try to keep them if you can. But sometimes you just got to let things be what they are. I couldn't get a prairie to grow no matter how hard I tried. But a little inland, a woodland area grew just fabulously. And I have a lot of violets and stuff like that. And maybe sometimes, not to put you out of a job, Miss Mason, because the state seems to want to do that for you, but let things grow that naturally grow there, and you'll have real good success. You know? I mean, you know, Mr. Inge's property at one time probably was a prairie. Prairie things might grow real good there. You know, somebody who lives in a forest area, forest stuff grows real good there. And maybe that's why, you know, have the creeping Charlie, or maybe not so much creeping Charlie, but the violets that grow in the woodlands grow real nice some places, and mm-hmm. just live with it. But so much for my commentary. The question I have is, how in the world can one grow a Japanese maple? Those things are ridiculously hard to get to grow. I've planted the seeds. They don't even grow.
Yeah, I think it is one of those things, and just talking about really what you'd mentioned too with your comment is just sort of understanding the soil and the light conditions and all that stuff about your property. And I think that tells us a lot of things. And it certainly falls in line with Japanese maples. And certainly the seeds are not particularly prolific. That's why Japanese maples tend to be a little bit more expensive, simply
they're
because
really
how they're yeah, and they don't grow very fast. So there's lots of reasons why they tend to be a little bit more expensive. So probably the biggest thing with Japanese maples is a couple of things. You'd want to get a variety that is really, especially since you're having problems, you might want to go with something like Blood Good or one of the varieties that's been around for a long time, tends to be more vigorous, and start out with something like that, because some of them are just a lot more touchy. And how are they touchy? They're touchy because they like really well-drained, they like moist soil, but they like well-drained soil. So it's kind of that, you know, how do you get both of those? So if they're wet for long periods of time, they don't like it, and they will definitely show you that with branch death or whatever. So they need that. They don't really like, you know, the best place would be something like the east side of a house where they're going to get morning sun. They get that cooler sun in the morning, and then they're shaded all afternoon. They're also protected against wind. So as you can see, there's lots of things. It's almost along the same lines of what we'd think of with azaleas and rhododendrons, where they like that sort of moist soil, slightly acidic, those kinds of things that sort of help us to get those kinds of things to grow. So I don't know if that helps you at all, but also just thinking about, you know, making sure they don't get get too dry in the summertime, mulching, all those things that can help to keep the soil moist. So
a neighbor has just a beautiful tree, and it seeds very, very regularly.
Mm-hmm.
And as most maple seeds, you take a maple seed and it's real soft, little seedlet, you know, with the winglets come down, you can squish the seed easy.
Mm-hmm.
This maple winglet comes down and the seed is like a rock. How do you start that thing to propagate?
I'm not sure about Japanese maples. That'd be one of those things we really have to check. I know some of the things like paper bark maples, which is one that I have, it sets lots of seed, what appear to be lots of seeds, but they're not viable seeds for whatever reason. So the seeds are there. It's just very rare to ever get one to actually go ahead and produce a plant. So, but I'm not sure with Japanese maples. That'd be something we'd have to check and see if maybe you have to like scratch the seed or something to sort of get through to that hard seed coat. So that'd be something I'd really have to check on, to be honest with you. So that's a tough one. But if they get in the right spot, you know, as your neighbor obviously has found that right spot, then they're gorgeous and they do very well. Yeah, I know, I know. So it's easy to covet them, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you. On to Pisotum for another caller here, line number two. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I have a mulberry tree that I let grow for birds and stuff, and unfortunately it's my garden area, and it just produces, it's big, it's pretty, but it has tons and tons of berries. Is there any way mm-hmm. to prevent the berries from setting, or am I going to have to do away with this tree?
Wow. There are some, and I'm just not sure if it's labeled for mulberries or not. That's something that we'd have to check. There's a couple of different things. There is a spray that can be used. Unfortunately, the timing has to be particularly important because basically it's just aborting the flowers. And so you have to spray when the flowers are just starting to come out. And so timing on that is really critical. There's also professional arborists. Actually, there is a trunk injection now, too. But again, I'm not sure if it's labeled on mulberries. That'd be a little bit of checking to find out. And probably if we were going to go that route, it'd be something where the trunk injection would probably be a better idea. That way you're not doing this broadcast sort of spray on a big tree like that, which is really hard. So you might want to check, I don't know if you have professional arborists in your area, you might want to check with them to see if there's some options for you. Unfortunately, it'd have to be done every year, and again, timing is critical on those.
Well, that's a good idea because it is pretty, and I let it go for the birds to have something to eat and everything, and I didn't have time to do the gardening. Now that I have time to do gardening, it's like walking through a I might as well be pressing grapes or something.
Yeah, it is something, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing.
Oh, I know.
Are they edible?
Sure. Absolutely.
You can collect
them. They're tasty.
I've heard somebody put like sheets or something out and catch them.
Yeah, trying to collect them, is another story altogether. But yeah, there actually is a variety. It came out of Illinois, and I'm trying to think of the name of it. You can actually purchase it in some of the catalogs. I think it's called a Illini something or other, and I can't remember. But anyway, yes, they're absolutely edible and really quite tasty. They don't have like big seeds or anything, and so they're really quite tasty. But the biggest thing, of course, is actually collecting them, like you said. So you kind of have to wait till they drop, and a sheet is as good as any. Hopefully a purple sheet, because that's what it'll end up being.
Yeah, that's no kid. Okay, really enjoy your show.
Okay,
thank you
good
so
luck.
Much. Bye-bye.
Our guest this morning is Sandy Mason. She's a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. Once a month, on a Tuesday, she's here, and we talk about lawn and garden care. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm sure that before now that there were some people who were really chomping at the bit. They were thinking about their lawns,
mm-hmm.
and they were thinking about either fertilization or weed control, or maybe because there are ways you can do that both at the same
mm-hmm.
time,
mm-hmm.
you know, that. And maybe we're thinking about, okay, when is the time?
Yeah.
I think we're actually pretty much at the time. Right now.
Yeah, and the thing I've noticed, obviously, is that the soil temperatures actually went up fairly quickly this year, and that typically is what we think of when we think about crabgrass control. We think about, you know, it needs to be at least 55 degrees for at least three consecutive days. Well, we hit that a long time ago.
Yeah.
Typically, you know, you put crabgrass control on by, you know, mid-April, you're fine. But this year is a little bit different. Things warmed up really quickly. So people could certainly think about doing that. And, you know, typically we think with fertilizer, we think of the 1st of May. We generally recommend people wait until the 1st of May. If you're doing a broadleaf weed control at the same time, generally that ends up being a little bit late if you're thinking about dandelions or whatever. So that that in between it would certainly be through the end of April is just fine.
Yeah,
so people haven't done that already.
We're there.
Yeah, sure. People wanted to do that, and certainly if they wanted to use a pre-emergent crabgrass control. But you know, the whole thing is always to think about, you know, why are you getting weeds? Are you getting weeds because there's open areas? So anytime you have an open soil area, you're going to get stuff coming in. So you may want to think about actually this time of year to go ahead and reseed or overseed and just thicken up the lawn and try to work at it from that direction, rather than just always thinking about herbicides. And this is a good time to do that. We typically have rains on a regular basis. I haven't quite gotten into that, so you may have to do a little bit more watering, but generally it's a good time to start them.
Okay. Let me ask you one other lawn-related here. This is an off-air question I've got, where we have someone who has concerned about grubs mm-hmm. in their lawn and wanted to know about when and how should treat. And one sort of wrinkle is that they have a pond that is down the slope. This is two small terraces, their lawn, and they have a pond that's down the slope from the terraces. And during the, I guess in the summertime, there are fish in the pond. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. he's really concerned that whatever he does on the grass to deal with the grubs, is that if that ends up filtering down into the pond, mm-hmm. I mean, he doesn't want to do anything that's going to hurt mm-hmm. the fish.
Mm-hmm. I guess my question is, and I realize we probably can't ask this of him, is have there been grubs problems in the past? If you haven't had grub problems in the past, I'm not sure I'd worry about it. The last couple of years, we really haven't had huge grub populations. A few people have noticed that, and certainly it tends to be on those highly manicured lawns because, you know, the beetle doesn't want to lay eggs in a hard grass somewhere. So she likes to lay eggs in those nice succulent areas where the soil's moist and all that. Mm-hmm. But we've had plenty of soil moisture in the past, and so they've laid eggs all over the place, and so we haven't had these concentrated areas. So if there hasn't been a problem with grubs in the past, I'd say don't worry about grub control, because he's absolutely right. You got to think about downstream. I'd also be thinking highly about what type of fertilizer he's using and how much he's fertilizing, because that can certainly end up in the water as well and cause some big problems. So I'd really also think about that fertilizer application, and may find that you want to maybe hold back on the amount of fertilizer, those kind of things and those kind of situations. So I'd really think about what the problems are, and rather than always think about these preventative kinds of things, really think about actually being, you know, waiting for it to happen. And sometimes it doesn't happen. So,
okay. On to somebody here on line number one. Hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, hi.
I have a boxwood hedge, and I've noticed that in the last summer, especially spring and summer, that the small leaves are dying on it in different patches. And I was wondering what's causing that and how I could cure it.
Mm-hmm. And this happens in the spring and summer? You get more dieback even in the summer? Because typically, you know, with boxwood, a lot, because they're broadleaf evergreens like that, that we very often will get some winter damage. So it's not uncommon this time of year. You notice that part of it is just kind of died back a little bit. So that would be common, just from the wind injury and winter injury and stuff. If you continue to get it through the summer, then you may have something else going on there. And I think about a couple things that they don't like really wet soils. They're one of those, again, that likes moist soil, but not really wet soil. And they don't like to be really dry either. So I don't know if any of that kind of fits in. Mulching can help to keep a nice moist soil. That can help. Now, they do get some canker diseases that will actually cause dieback on branches. So it may be one of those things where if this seems to be just a regular thing, you may find you want to go ahead and bring in a sample either to the U of I plant clinic or local extension office to see if you can get a better idea. If this seems to be a regular thing, I'd really think about that. But as you cut them out, what you might want to do is just make sure that you cut beyond into the good stuff, and don't just cut off the dead stuff, if that makes sense. And so hopefully you're actually, if it is a disease, you're helping to get rid of it. And then you may want to use like alcohol or Lysol or something on the pruners as you make your cuts, and that way you're not transferring a disease, if it is a disease. That'd be one way to sort of, you know, hopefully sort of hold back if there is, might be a disease problem.
I have noticed that the parts that have died are closer to the house and stay in the shade longer.
Oh.
What you say about it being damp might also make some sense.
Right. So there may be some things you need to think about a little bit on that. And obviously, this last year was we had so much moisture this year. Now, it definitely starts happening again this year where we had this dry spring. Then I'd really start wondering a little bit if it isn't something else going on. But.
All right. I'll
okay. Good luck.
Mm-hmm. Right. Thank you.
Thank you. Well, I have an email here from a fan, someone who says that they enjoy hearing you on the show and also like your column. And they have a question about sweet gums. They say they have two sweet gum trees in their yard. They like the tree as far as the foliage is concerned, but the balls, they attack the house, the eaves, the porches. She said most of them fall into their hosta garden, which is nearby. So the question is, should you just leave them in there as mulch, or would that be bad for the hostas? And should she try to rake up the sweet gum balls and get rid of them?
Well, I think, and thanks for the kind words, I think a couple things. Actually, what I've heard, what people have told me, I don't know how well this holds out, but people have told me that they put sweet gum balls around their hostas and stuff to keep the rabbits out. And then somebody told me that they thought it also helped to keep slugs away. So I don't know if that's true. I could see rabbits maybe not liking it all that much. So it may actually be a good thing that it's in the hosta bed. It's certainly not going to hurt the plants, the hostas at all. It's just, and so I would, that is just fine to go ahead and use them as mulch if you want to. I mean, they eventually will break down, but maybe a little bit harder for her to walk in or him to walk in. But that, so no, it's certainly not going to hurt the plants, and it may actually be helping with other critter issues.
Okay, very good. Back to the phones, and someone in Bartlett on our Line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, I was wondering, is there a way you could take care of grubs without using chemicals naturally?
I don't know of any natural kind of chemical for grubs. I think probably the few things, I guess that, you know, they really have to reach high populations in order to really cause problems.
That's the problem I have where I'm at now. It's just my grass is terrible. It's been like that the last couple of years, and I've sprayed stuff on there.
And you
I
know
mean,
it's
that spread, and it's still I still have a problem. Now the house next door to me is foreclosed on, so nobody's done any treatment on the lawn for 2 years.
Right, right.
And I know they've been in there, but it's just a reoccurring situation. And right now, I've got animals around here, plus I've got a koi in a fish pond, and I lost half my koi last year because I sprayed because somebody said to spray, and I'm trying to get away from the toxic stuff, you know, and I can't seem to find anybody in Illinois, even when I go to the extension office over here, that can give me the right answer and try some company, because I've seen it online out of state in other states supply natural ways of taking care of pests like this. But anyway,
right.
I get off and listen. Thank you.
Well, my question was, and maybe he's already off, but is it, if you know it's actually grubs, because there's certainly lots of things that will cause damage on lawns and not necessarily grubs. So grubs should be one of those things where they eat off the roots, and it should basically, the grass kind of folds back like a bad toupee kind of thing, because they're eating off the roots, and it kills. And you'd actually see the grubs where it's still green. You'd see them on the perimeter where it's still green. And generally, we don't have problems with grubs until they start getting about 10 per square foot. So if you're digging around, you plant a tree, and you see two or three grubs, I wouldn't worry about it, because that's not a high enough population to worry about. So make sure it's grubs. The other thing is, there is a product for Japanese beetle grubs called Milky Spore that is available that you can use to kill the grubs, but it's really only affected on Japanese beetle grubs. We have other grubs like annual white grub and a few others that it doesn't seem to be as effective on. But certainly if it's Japanese beetle grubs, that would be something that could be used, and it's just called Milky Spore, and I think it's the brand name's Doom or something like that. Great name, huh? Doom. So you can find those kind of products, and certainly that would be something that he could try.
Okay.
But I'd make sure that it's really a grub issue and not some other kinds of things going on within the lawn.
And I think also from having talked to Phil about this, Phil Nixon, if what we're talking about is annual white grub, also the timing of the treatment is really crucial. There's a particular time.
Right.
And as I remember, isn't it in August?
Yeah, depending on what product you use, if it's something that generally we say July, only because some of the products now, it used to be August, but a lot of the products now actually take a few weeks to actually become active. So usually we're saying more like the 1st of July or so, and that way it gives it a few weeks because they'll start laying their eggs. Usually around 4th of July, the annual white grub will actually, the annual white beetle, the June beetle, will lay eggs.
Yeah.
Right, will lay eggs usually around the 4th of July, and then they start coming out in August. So you're absolutely right on that. So timing's important. This time of year, we don't worry so much about grub control because the grubs are going to be pupating soon. They're big. They're hard to kill. They're going to be pupating. So that's why we think about that next generation.
Okay. Well, sometime I'm hoping with the next couple of weeks, Phil will be here. Phil Nixon, he's an extension entomologist, and he particularly when it's warm and there's a lot of insect stuff
right.
going on. We have him on the show to help people deal with insect pest problems. So if that caller can, you know, keep listening, and we'll let you know
sure.
when Phil's going to be here. He probably, more than anybody, hardly anybody else, he'd
he
be the guy to
them.
Talk to.
Yeah, he knows insects very
yes,
well.
Yes, knows insects very well and knows how to. He's always, the thing I appreciate with Phil is that he's kind of a go-along kind of guy. He says, okay, now, can you live with this? If so,
yeah,
okay.
I think
but if
that's
you
how we all
absolutely
have
to be. Can't live with it, he can tell you what
right,
to,
right,
to do
right.
about it.
And I think that's a good way to go through life,
okay.
I think.
We're kind of coming down to the end here. Is there anything in the way of events or anything that you might that's coming up you might want to talk about?
Yeah, I certainly want to mention, you know, I think a lot of people are always interested in the U of I Hort Club's Flower Show, which is this weekend, Friday and Saturday, at the Stock Pavilion. And I know people love to go to that. It's a great opportunity to get some ideas about gardening, but also just to do a little shopping. So this weekend, Stock Pavilion, Saturday and Sunday, people want to check that out. I know it seems like a long ways off, but the Champaign County Master Gardeners Garden Walk is June 26th this year, so Saturday, June 26th, and it's going to be a great day. We always have demonstrations at the Idea Garden as well as some great garden vendors, and so people can do a little shopping, learn a few things, and then go around and see a bunch of great gardens.
Yeah, that's it's always a nice
it's
event because it's great to see. It's the opportunity to go. It's like people always want to look in somebody else's house.
Sure.
And see what they got. This is a chance to look in their yard at least.
Legally.
And legally, yeah. Walk around in their yard. People are really nice, and they actually open up their yards for people to come. And it's always interesting to see. Maybe you see different kinds of plants that you're not familiar with or ways of using plants and see what people have done with their yards. And it's a good way to come away from that with some ideas about things that you might like to try in your own yard.
Sure, sure. So it's
okay.
a great opportunity.
Okay. Any last sort of thing you might like to mention?
I think, you know, get out and just enjoy. You know, if you have things like pruning, dividing perennials and stuff, I'd be getting it done here real soon. Typically, we could do it through the whole month of April, but I don't think I'd delay a whole lot of things because we just don't know what the weather's going to be. And then also keep in mind, you know, we can still get some frosts. Absolutely can get some frosts. So
yeah.
Don't be too anxious, even though it's been warm. Don't be too anxious to be setting out things like tomatoes and peppers and stuff unless you know you can cover them. Later.
So the average day of last frost is Thursday. It's the 15th. So that's the average.
Average. So
it actually is possible we could get
yeah,
some out to
yeah,
that. So if
absolutely.
It's something that's really tender, you want to be, you know, careful
yeah,
and,
yeah.
and don't put
yeah,
stuff
yeah.
out.
Yeah,
because like
2 years ago we had that. It got into the 20s in late April, and it really hit things hard. So don't get
yeah.
too anxious just
okay.
yet. It's hard, but.
Sandy Mason is a horticulture educator with U of I Extension in Champaign County. She's on this program once a month. It's always on a Tuesday. Also, you might look for her on the program Illinois Gardener. That's on our companion TV station, WYLL-TV. That's Thursday nights at 7. And there is Diane Nolan is the host of the show. And then there's an ever-changing cast of experts, cast of characters, who are there to ask to answer questions. And it's a live show. And they take questions. So if you like to do gardening, that's a show you're going to want to see. Illinois Gardener, WYLL-TV, Thursday nights, 7 o'clock. And Sandy will be back next month, and
yes,
it'll be what,
you.
May?
Yeah, hard to believe, isn't it?
Incredible. Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
Well, in just a moment here, we will have our usual break that we take so we can bring you an update on the egg markets, and then we'll have some news from National Public Radio. And speaking of National Public Radio, in the next hour of the program, the second hour of the program, our guest will be Alicia Shepherd. She is the ombudsman for NPR. She's also a journalist who's had a lot of experience writing about media and also doing reporting. And she has an interesting and I think kind of difficult position because she's the person that when there are complaints about things on NPR, she's the person that goes to the reporter or goes to the people who have made the decisions to find out, well, why did you do this that way, to try to explain that to listeners? Not so much justify it, but to explain. So anyway, we'll be talking with her in the next part of the show. We also want to take a moment or two here to encourage people to support this station with their dollars. This is one of those times we sit here in front of the microphone and say, look, folks, without you and your support, we just can't do what we do. And now's the time that you can make a big difference by giving us a call. Jack Brighton is here with me, too. He's the guy who right now is in charge of our the stuff that we do on the internet.
Yes, and I want to echo David's call. We need your help. This is one of those times when we come to you directly and ask for your contribution. 217-244-9455 is an easy way to make a phone call and a pledge in just about a minute. You can also go online to willpledge.org and make a contribution there. And we really, you know, David has been doing the show for a long time. I used to be his producer, and I'm very proud of that history, that, you know, my earlier career before I got all into technology and weird stuff. Anyway, this show has been putting out educational, you know, informational, community-oriented programs on a broad and deep and rich range of topics that are vital to understanding the world. And we give all this away for free. We must be nuts. You know, how can we afford to do that?
How can we afford to do that? We're going to have to talk. Well, is it volume?
I think that's what it is.
Okay.
Right, exactly. But actually, the truth is that we depend upon you, the people who enjoy the programs, who benefit from them. We're asking you to make a voluntary contribution. We must be nuts. But that's the way we do it here in public radio. So your pledge call right now to 217-244-9455 is extremely important.
And we fundraise ahead. So what we're doing now is we're raising the money that will support the programs for the next fiscal year, the one that begins on the 1st of July. Now, last year in July, we sat down and we started thinking, all right, how much money are we going to need? And we set this goal that we wanted to raise $2.1 million. Now, that is the money that will support the programs you appreciate. Unfortunately, back then in July, we didn't know where we were going to be right now. We certainly didn't know that there would be additional state budget cuts. They affect the university. That affects us. In fact, there are some that affected us directly. So I know everybody is, but we're certainly experiencing real serious budget pressure. The only thing we can do is turn to listeners and say, well, if the programming is important to you, now's the time for you to step up and help to support it.
That's right. Willpledge.org, that's our website where you can make an online contribution, and that will literally take about 30 seconds. Or the phone number to call is 217-244-9455. And we have a goal this week of 1,000 pledges. We're hoping to reach that goal. That's kind of where we need to get to. We're about a third of the way there, folks. And this is only Monday, so we're doing very, very well. You're doing very, very well. We appreciate all of those who have already called in or gone to willpledge.org. But we have a ways to go. So to keep things rolling here, your contribution, once again, 217-244-9455 or willpledge.org.